Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for tuning in. Hope you've had a wonderful weekend. Glad to have you along. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross Controls. Carissa's at the phones. Looking forward to a good conversation today as we talk about kind of working through differences and handling conflict. You know, it's that old gospel chorus we used to sing, "They'll know we are Christians by our love." Was that one of your regulars?
Sure, around the campfire particularly.
Yeah. And, of course, Jesus said the world would know that we are his followers when we love one another. So as you observe Christians in the midst of disagreement, how would you say we're doing it, demonstrating Christ's love?
A little work to do, perhaps.
A little work to do. Okay. Well, this will be a little remedial course today. We're going to talk redeeming conflict in just a few minutes with Ann Garrido. Looking forward to hearing that. I do want to just say that the Bible has a lot to say about how we live out our lives and handle conflicts and every other thing. And we've got a great Bible giveaway that's going on here for the next, I think, two more weeks. There's still an opportunity for you to sign up to win a copy of the She Reads Truth Bible. Just came out here not too long ago, and we're giving away copies here through Mother's Day. So you can sign up today at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com. A little bit later this week, we'll talk with one of the content providers in that. That doesn't sound quite right in terms of content provider or writing a Bible. But she's
that'd be an amazing interview.
Well, that would sure. We're reaching for the top here. But we'll tell you more about that here later this week. But you can sign up today at myfaithradio.com.
Through Mother's Day, you said, right? So that's just this week.
Yeah, but I think maybe
carry it over.
I think so. But but why wait?
All right.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Get on there right now.
Sure. Okay. Well, today we're going to talk Redeeming Conflict, 12 Habits for Christian Leaders. It's a book, I think a fairly recent book, came out from Ann Garrido. Ann is a writer, educator, administrator, and communications consultant who has a passion for bringing the best research and practice around healthy communication and conflict management from the business world into the church world. She's an associate professor of homiletics at Aquinas Institute of Theology in St. Louis, and has served as senior editor of Human Development magazine, is the author of 6 books, including Redeeming Conflict and the award-winning Redeeming Administration. She's a good friend of Sheila Heen, which is, we talked to Sheila last Monday. We talked a little bit about some personal conflict. We thought we'd move it into maybe more of the church realm a bit today and bring in Ann for that. Ann, welcome to Connecting Faith. Good to have you along.
Thank you so much, Neil. It's an honor to be with you.
Ted and I were just talking about, you know, how Christians should be known by their love. And the book you've written is about 12 habits for Christian leaders. And I guess as you look across the spectrum of maybe, Christian behavior today, how are we at demonstrating Christ's love when it comes to this area of conflict and disagreement?
Well, I think one of the things is that love itself isn't synonymous with being nice. So there's lots of different ways to love. How are we loving? That is a big question. But I would want to say that it's not just to be assessed by, like, how kind we are being to each other. Love takes a lot of different forms, and I think many people are trying to live love authentically, but it's tough.
Well, in fact, that maybe is one of the challenges, isn't it? Because we sort of swing one way on the pendulum maybe versus the other, the one that let's avoid conflict altogether, or maybe the other is, well, we're going to just garner power through others. So talk about maybe those two extremes.
Yeah. This notion of love, oftentimes in our own mind, like we will think that it means being meek or subservient. And oftentimes love, we know, is one of the deepest powers that actually exists. So all persons, no matter how that they're acting out in the world, many of them would say, I'm doing it motivated by love, but the other person doesn't always experience these actions as loving. And so what we're trying to look for is ways in which we can both be deeply loving and strong and assertive and working for what we believe is the good in the world, and doing it in such a way that the other person experiences it as a form of love in their own life.
Is this something that you kind of developed as just growing up? I know, reading a little bit about your bio, that you're a family of eight children, that you by age 12 you were designing week-long retreat experiences, and you're constructing elaborate lesson plans and schedules for the Attic Academy. Your siblings refused to attend, and they wouldn't go to the week-long retreat experiences either. So, I mean, was it just a matter of you getting your way at home that this has been kind of a lifelong passion?
That's a great question. It's true. I am the oldest of eight, and I, from a very, very early age, was intrigued by working for the church. Probably a little bit, I had it in my bone, but also I remember growing up and hearing about the book of Acts, especially during this Easter season, about how all the disciples of Jesus, at that day after Pentecost, they heard the gospel, they handed over all of their money to the church, and then in my mind, what I heard was, and this is the place where everybody's just going to live happily ever after. And so I started actually working for the church around the age of 14. Had to go outside of the home because my siblings didn't want to do everything that I wanted them to do and attend my imaginary classroom and so forth. And very quickly, even as a teenager, I began to realize, hey, the church, even as deeply loving as it is not a place where necessarily people are going to live it's just happily ever after. So I wanted to try to figure out, well, are there ways in which the church can model reconciliation and peacemaking done really well? It can model conflict done really well, even when we are in a space where sometimes it's going to be tough and we're not all going to get along with each other.
Well, obviously, we're in the season leading up to Pentecost and Acts 4. You address that in your book. Say maybe a bit more about that, kind of unpack that, what that tells us about redeeming conflict. I don't know if we've read that. I don't know if we've read that passage necessarily in thought in terms of conflict before.
Yeah. So one of the stories we know from Genesis way, way back is that story of Babel, in which people who wanted to do a common project with each other, that their languages were all split, and that their difference of language, their inability to understand each other, fragmented them so that they could no longer work together in any way. And what we see on the Feast of Pentecost in that story, a beautiful story from Acts, is that when the Holy Spirit enters the picture at Pentecost, the Spirit doesn't actually remove the diversity that exists within this community, but instead, even while people are all speaking different languages, what the Spirit enables them to do is to understand what each other is saying, even as they speak in different tongues. Some biblical scholars like Walter Brueggemann or Eric Law speak about it. What happened on Pentecost, we could think of as a miracle of the ears, that all of a sudden, even in the midst of our diversity, we were able to understand each other in a whole new way.
Which I guess is always one of the things that our mom said, right? You've got two ears and one mouth, so you should listen twice as much as you should speak, right? Is that principle still hold true?
I do think often when we go into conversations that we ourselves are finding tough, we will go in with the purpose like, well, let me explain to you my point of view. I need to share with you and try to persuade you to look at things the way I do. And if we go into difficult conversations doing twice as much listening as we plan on doing speaking, we would get a lot farther. So part of what I try to cover in the book is what kinds of questions would really help us to understand better where the other person is coming from and help us to see a little bit more about why do we see this differently? What does it look like from your point of view, not just from my point of view?
And I know that you've worked with the Sheila Heen's group, the Triad Consulting Group, and helping the mm-hmm. Harvard Negotiation Project. So, I mean, this is really something that is obviously you're focusing on habits for Christian leaders, but this is really universal information, isn't it?
Sure. And in fact, I myself, as a Christian leader, have derived a huge amount of learning from the Harvard Negotiation Project's work. So as you mentioned, having grown up Christian my entire life, part of a large Christian family that tried to live love really, really well. One of the things I discovered was like, yes, I totally believe in the Bible. I want to live this way in my life. But sometimes I found, how do I do it? That's tricky. So what I discovered in reading the literature from the Harvard Negotiation Project was that it gave me really concrete tools and strategies for living out the values that my heart was convicted of.
In the moments ahead, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and there's a couple of different books that have been super helpful in that way to me. Sheila's book and Doug's book, Difficult Conversations. Also their book, Thanks for the Feedback. But some of the wider literature from that field, we as Christians actually have a lot to learn from the business and the legal professions who have been asking some of the same questions as what we have.
We're going to learn how to ask some of those questions, review some of those questions in the moments ahead, and we'll talk about, you know, how do we honor the emotions of others in a conflict? How do we address conflicts with those in authority? And how do we not become defensive when we're getting feedback? All those kinds of things. Talking about redeeming conflict. You know, it may seem counterintuitive that conflict can be a blessing. We'll hear more in the moments ahead with Ann Garrido, who's a writer, educator, administrator, communications consultant. She's authored several books, including the one we're referencing today, Redeeming Conflict, 12 Habits for Christian Leaders. You can join the conversation with us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And we'll talk more in just a moment. Today, associate professor of homiletics at Aquinas Institute of Theology in St. Louis, writer, educator, administrator, communications consultant, has a passion for bringing the best research and practice around healthy communication and conflict management from the business world into the church world. And we're talking about one of our books called Redeeming Conflict, 12 Habits for Christian Leaders. And we know that we're told to always be ready to give an answer for the hope that we have. We're to do that, to speak up with gentleness and respect. And you addressed that kind of early on in the book. Just say a little bit more about that before we dive into some of those maybe challenges of conflict resolution. So why gentleness and respect, and what does that look like in practical terms?
Yeah. As we spoke about earlier before the break, many of us have an imagination in our own minds that love means only being on the listening side, or only asking questions, or only like kind of deferring to what the other person's will is and seeing if we can figure out a way of agreeing with them. And I think love also has a real strength to it that requires an ability to speak up around what it is that we see. Nobody has the complete view of reality. Nobody has all of the information that could be gleaned. And we go into these conversations with humility, realizing that there's always more to learn, but recognizing also our perceptive of what is true and what's real also needs to be part of the conversation. And so speaking up about what it is that we see to be true, and asking questions about it, getting the other person's perspective on how do they read on their read on our read, all of those things are really an important part of difficult conversation, too. It's not just about the other person speaking. It's also about finding your own voice and your own perspective and putting it out there.
You talk about a principle of charitable interpretation. Say more about that, the difference between the intent and impact.
Yeah. So one of the things from the field of philosophy is that when we're listening to somebody else whose argument we oftentimes disagree with, we would go in with that principle of charitable interpretation, that we would assume that the other person is sane and being and doing what they're doing because it makes sense to them. And so part of the goal is to try to figure out with the other person, why does this, like, you're looking at this so different than the way that I look at it, but I know that from your point of view, this has to make sense. And part of my goal is to figure out, why does this make sense for you? Not that I'm necessarily going to agree with you, but I want to try to understand better what this looks like through your eyes. And a tricky thing about difficult conversations is we oftentimes will entangle intent and impact. So we will assume that if something's had a bad impact on us, that the other person must have intended to have a bad impact on me, or at least that they have some sort of character flaw that made them oblivious to the fact of what kind of impact they were going to have on me. So that if I'm offended, the other person must have intended to offend me, or the other person just must be kind of careless or thoughtless with what they're saying. The flip of it, though, is that when we ourselves have really good intentions, we will tend to think that regardless of the impact on other people, they should understand, well, at least, you know, I had good intentions there. Or they should understand that they shouldn't be mad at us for what happened to them, because they should know, well, I didn't mean for something bad to happen to you. So one of the things that can be really helpful in a tricky conversation is disentangle those two, or as I talk about in the book, unknot those two. Realize that it's possible to have really good intentions and the other person be impacted negatively. And it's possible that we might be impacted negatively and the other person could actually have good intentions.
And is one of the ways to disentangle, to unknot, is to simply ask the kind of a straightforward question, like, why does this make sense for you? You were talking about it, or is there a better way to put that?
That's a great one. One of the things I would say is, I would just say, you know, from my point of view, this is kind of how I'm seeing it. But my guess is, you know, you're sitting in a different place. You've got different information than what I've got. What do you think I'm missing? So what do you think should be brought into this conversation that hasn't been brought up so far? That what am I missing can be a really helpful way of finding out what's in the other person's story. And when I've been hurt by something, just checking out, saying something like, you know what, I realize that this hit me in a way, like I was really impacted by this in a negative way. I was hurt by what was said, or I was hurt by the fact that I didn't get a reply back on that letter or email. But I'm guessing your intention was not to hurt me. And could you say a little bit more about what motivated you? What was it that was in your thinking when you were doing what you were doing? And that kind of language can help a lot.
Do the dynamics change when you're maybe addressing conflict with those in authority? I mean, it's one thing maybe if it's a husband or wife, or it's, you know, coworkers or friends. But if it's your boss, someone in authority, does that make a difference?
Mm-hmm. It's tricky, isn't it? Because we're always filtering what feels safe to say out loud and what needs to be just kept inside of my own mind. But I
Which
think
is where I had some of my best
principle.
Conversations, I have to say, really, in my own mind. I don't know about you.
Inside of your own mind.
Those are always solid. There's you know, every argument makes complete sense, too. That's the thing.
Isn't that the truth? So one of the things that can be super helpful in getting ready for a tricky conversation, especially if it's going to be with somebody in authority that you're a little scared to speak up with, is doing some negotiation with your own, what we could call your own internal voice, the voice inside of your head, before getting into the conversation. Because part of the goal of the conversation is to draw out the other person's internal voice. What really is going on for the other person inside of their head? Which is what we were just talking about. Like, why does this make sense to you? Why are we looking at this differently? How are you seeing it? Or what do you think I'm missing? But the other really important part is negotiating with your own internal voice and making peace in some ways with what's in, recognizing even, what are all the things that are going on inside of my head? And if I know I'm going to have a conversation with somebody in advance, there's some questions I can ask myself before going in to make sure that I've negotiated my own internal voice into a place of curiosity and a place where I can be careful about what do I really want to bring out into the open, into the conversation, and what are things that I actually just want to keep inside of my own voice, inside of my head.
So maybe just give us a couple examples, asking ourselves questions. Would they just be those two that you've referenced, or are there others that we should be asking? Because, you know, this does reveal something about ourselves, the way we approach conflict, doesn't it?
Sure. So if I have the gift of knowing in advance that I need to bring up something that's really tough, I will oftentimes just sit and journal, and I'll write out the whole story from my point of view. But then before ever going into the conversation, I'll try to write out the story from the other person's point of view. How do I imagine they would tell the story about what's going on? And when I begin to write out stuff from their point of view, I will begin to recognize that there's big holes in the story that I'm telling, that I don't really know what's motivating them. I think I do, but I'm not really sure about that. I'll recognize that there's big parts that, like, oh, maybe I have this information, but they don't have this information. What information do they have that I don't have? And so when I try to write out the story from their point of view, afterwards I'll just go through with a highlighter and realize where are the holes, and those are the places, those are the questions that I want to bring up into the conversation. So that when I go into a tough conversation, I've got a number of questions that I want to make sure that I ask. The information the other person's got that I don't actually have. And when I'm coaching people around difficult conversations, I would say don't even go into the conversation unless you have at least one really good question. Because that lets you know that you're approaching it from a stance of curiosity rather than just going into the conversation in order to give the other person a piece of your mind and just like or just explode on them. It puts me into a state where I'm going in knowing this is what I want to make sure that I leave the conversation finding out more about.
You know, it works well when we're sort of rational and we got time to think it through, but oftentimes it seems like we're in the midst of the battle and there are emotions that are showing up, and we got a couple of minutes before the break, but say a bit about, you know, engaging or honoring emotions in a conflict, and especially the emotions of others.
Yeah, oftentimes we will think, well, the conversation would go much better if we could just eliminate emotions. If we just kept this to the level of reason, you know, we would be able to move this along more quickly. The thing to recognize is that if there weren't emotions involved, this wouldn't actually be a tough conversation. So if neither of us had emotions, if we had choices about whether we have emotions or not, it wouldn't be tough. But the reality is we do have emotions. So the big question is, How do we work with those negotiations and handle them in a really substantive and meaningful way within the conversation? Yeah, both our own and the other person's strong emotions.
Let's talk a bit more about that on the other side of the break. You take a little break and come back and have more from Ann Garrido, who her bio says she travels nationally, internationally, doing conflict. That's until you read the rest of the sentence, but it does... It does make it sound like an interesting career. But no, she does conflict education and mediation work. That makes all the difference. Ann is a writer, educator, administrator, and communications consultant. She's authored six books, including Redeeming Conflict and the award-winning Redeeming Administration, and is joining us today here on Connecting Faith to talk about redeeming conflicts, habits for Christian leaders. And coming up in just a moment, we'll talk a bit more about emotions within the conflict. I also want to get some conversation going on about feedback. You get defensive when you get feedback and criticism. Do you overreact? All right, we'll talk about sort of the two ends of the continuum there. You're welcome to join the conversation, too, and maybe have a question, specific question that relates to our conversation. We'd love to have you in on the conversation at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. We'll talk more with Ann Garrido in just a moment.
Connecting faith to life together on Faith Radio.
Get to conversation about forgiveness in a moment, talking with Ann Garrido, who's a writer, educator, and administrator, and communications consultant. And she's written several books, including Redeeming Administration and Redeeming Conflict. That's one we're referencing today. It's 12 Habits for Christian Leaders. Ann's associate professor of homiletics at Aquinas Institute of Theology in St. Louis. And Ann, we were talking just before the break a little bit about, you know, honoring emotions of others in a conflict. Say a little bit more about maybe what that looks like.
Yeah, even though it seems counterintuitive because we think, well, we just want to keep this at the fact level, at the reason level, one of the most productive things that we can actually do in a tough conversation is acknowledge the feelings that are going on and bring them explicitly into the conversation. So it means sometimes being willing to lay your own feelings out on the table. Now, that is not the same thing as getting emotional, right? So it's possible to say, you know what, I'm really frustrated by this. I'm irritated that we're having the same conversation again. It feels to me like we're stuck in a circle. That is not the same thing as screaming or slamming a door or, and saying, I'm really sad. I'm disappointed by this. Not the same thing as the wailing and gnashing of teeth. So it's possible to name our emotions and get them out onto the table. And oftentimes what we discover is that it brings the conversation to a different level. Now, the other person also probably has really strong emotions around this conversation that you're having too. And it's likely that they're not going to name them for you explicitly at that, like to say, oh, I'm feeling kind of sad right now, or I'm disappointed. A lot of times emotion comes out disguised in the language of accusation, of judgment. But one of the more helpful things that we can do when we recognize the other has strong feelings around something is to reframe what it is that they've said in terms of emotion. So when the other person is saying, you know, like, you just don't even care about the kids, you're not paying attention to the kids in the classroom, we can say that it sounds like you're really worried that the kids' needs aren't being met. Or it sounds like you're frustrated by what you've been seeing. Tell me more about that. And it's taking things that are being thrown at us and accusations and judgments and just shifting them a little to naming what do we hear as the feeling that's underneath for the other person. Oftentimes brings a new level of depth and can also insert some calm into the conversation.
And you also talk about the overreaction that we sometimes get into, whether, you know, if we're the recipient of the accusation or judgment or criticism, we get defensive. We say, well, it's not true. But then we can maybe swing to the other side and say, well, it's all true. Talk about that pendulum swing.
So one of the things that's been discovered in the research on conversations that people find tough is that whenever a person finds a conversation tough, like we all find different conversations tough, but when someone finds a conversation tough, it's always for the same three reasons. We have a difference of perception around story, which is what we were talking about earlier. We have really strong feelings about it, and the other person probably does too. And the third thing is that there's always some level of identity that's involved. That somehow what the conversation is about, whether explicitly or implicitly, has some implications for how we think about ourselves. And this kind of conversation is the kind of conversation, whereas we might bring up the feelings outside with others and talk about feelings, or we want to be explicit and talk about how our different points of view, or how we see the story in a different way. The conversation about identity and how we like to think of ourselves is often a conversation that we need to have inside of ourselves, about ourselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So even as I'm talking with the other person and I'm trying to learn more from their point of view and we're talking about how we feel about this, at the same time, I also need to spend a little bit of time talking to myself, saying, hey, right now the information that you're getting what's tough about it is it's saying some things about you that you're not coming across the way that you'd like to come across in the world. So for myself, for example, I like to think of myself as really hardworking. And often the conversations I'm going to find the toughest are where somebody insinuates, maybe, like I said, not even explicitly, but somebody insinuates, hey, you're not as organized as you think that you are. Or, hey, you let that ball drop. Those are the conversations I find really tough, because they're letting me know I'm not showing up the way that I would like to think of myself showing up in the world. And at those times, I need to do a little bit of negotiation internally. And part of that has to do with right-sizing the information I'm getting. Because, Neil, as you said, we will tend to go in one of two extremes. Either we'll become really defensive, like, well, what they're saying right now is not true. There's no way. I let that ball drop because I didn't have all the information that you were supposed to send me on time. Or on the other side, inside of our head, we'll be like, oh my, what if they're right? Like, what if I'm really, what if I did let the ball drop? That's such a bad thing to do because in my own imagination, I'm violating one of my own values. And I need to be able to say to myself in those moments, hey, this is not the whole of who you are. This is tough for you to hear right now. And you know yourself well enough to know that in a period of time, you will have incorporated this information into your life, and you will have reached back to kind of your balance point. Now, I know if someone says something to me that really is hard on how I like to think of myself being, it'll take me about 24 hours before I can stop cycling in my own brain like a gerbil on a wheel. It'll take probably another 72 hours before I stop thinking about it between 2 and 4 in the morning. But then I know myself well enough to know that in a week, I'm going to be back to normal, and I will have been able to incorporate this new data from this other person into my life. And when I'm really struggling internally in the middle of a hard conversation, sometimes it can help to feed myself just sort of a soothing message saying, this is tough now. In a week, you're going to be fine. And what are ways that we find to self-calm ourselves and to help our internal voice reach a little bit of peace, even in tough situations?
I just like the idea of just that alone, about sort of giving yourself 72 hours. Say, you know, this is going to sting for a little while, but you'll be fine, you know, and kind of cut yourself a bit of slack. We're talking about habits for Christian leaders. Forgiveness should be a central theme of our life and behavior, but is it just a matter of letting it go? Do we just kind of let some of this stuff wash off, say, all right, for the sake of, my faith walk, we'll overlook this?
Oh, would that it be that easy, huh? I think one of the things that I really learned the most in the writing of this book was I did a lot of reading and research on this topic of forgiveness. And one of the things that I came to resonate and believe very deeply is that forgiveness is not something that actually we have as human beings the capacity to do on our own. Forgiveness is really a divine gift. It's a gift that belongs to God. It's a gift that God often willingly shares with us if we ask, but it's not something that we can actually demand of ourselves. And the reason I say that is when a really big hurt has come into somebody's life, to say, well, you need to be able to forgive this, often the person's like, I don't have it within myself to forgive this yet. And they end up beating up on themselves for not being able to forgive. So I was influenced a lot in the thinking by Desmond Tutu and his work that he's done with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa. And he's got in his book called The Book of Forgiveness, it's a wonderful book, he has a prayer before forgiveness where he says, God, I think I'm in the space I really would like to be able to let this go. I'm not quite there yet, but this is the prayer before forgiveness. It's like I'm putting you on alert, Lord. I would like to be able to let this go. And any time that you'd like to share that gift with me, I would be willing to receive it. So it's saying we can't demand of ourselves that we be able to forget, that we be able to let go, but we can ask God for help in that. And often we find God is generous with that gift.
We just have a few minutes left. I wonder if we can talk. There's another sort of set of, I guess, extremes that can maybe keep us off balance. That being one side says, well, we got to fix it now, whatever the problem is, got to be hard on the problem. The other says, well, it can't be fixed, or maybe we just need to be soft. Talk about that continuum and some balance between those.
Yeah, a lot of times, and this comes from a classic book called Getting to Yes, but Christians, we can use this resource a lot. We will think either we'd be hard on the problem, but then when we're hard on the problem, we tend to be really hard on the people as well. Or because we want to preserve relationship, we're really soft on the people, but we also end up being really soft on the problem. And what Getting to Yes, and again, that whole body of literature from the Harvard Negotiation Project espouses is, hey, there are ways of being hard on the problem and soft on the people, kind to the relationship. And that's really what we're after. As Christians, we want to be assertive. We want to make sure we get our voice in there. We want our perspective to be heard, and we want to do it in such a way that it knits our relationships tighter rather than fragmenting them.
This seems like we're certainly in a season where there's maybe the kindest way we could put it is large amounts of disrespect going on politically.
Oh,
certainly, You know, any maybe lessons that we can draw from this, maybe your writings and study on this that would help us tone that down a little?
I think what we were just talking about has great relevance in the contemporary context. Right now, I think in being hard on problems, we're actually being really hard on people. And so what we want to do is to get as – we want to come up with as many options as possible and meet as many interests as we possibly can as possible, and do it in such a way that continues to value relationships. And my hope in working on the whole project on redeeming conflict was that we could equip Christians to live those kinds of lives, to be hard on problems, to really be salt and leaven out in the world, to be a constructive force for change in the world, and do it in such a way that deepens relationships and enhances community and communion with one another.
Well, certainly as Christians, we like to think, well, we've got the truth, but sometimes it ends up being more my truth probably than the truth, isn't it?
Sure. None of us has all that is to be known. As one of my friends oftentimes says, reality is like a billion watts of electricity, and all of us only are gifted with a 60-watt bulb. So reality is so much bigger than what any of our brains are able to comprehend. But each of us needs to shine the light that we're able to shine. And each of us, you know, needs to receive as much truth and try to take in as much truth as possible, recognizing that truth is always bigger than what any one person is able to grasp. So we have to be humble in realizing there is always more to learn from each other.
Well, from the 40-watt bulb here at Connecting Faith, just want to thank you, Anne, for coming on with us here. So I'm not even sure I'm quite at 60
thanks.
Watts, but we're...
Neil, I bet you're 80.
Well, I don't know, you know, but it's of course it's one of those long life ones. That's the key. So it's I'm not
awesome.
Using up a lot of electricity. So it's all about green here. Anne, good to visit with you. Blessings on your day. So glad that you've written the book and helped us through this today. We enjoy the conversation.
Neil and Ted, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. Anne Garrido, my guest today. She's a writer, educator, administrator. The book we referenced called Redeeming Conflict, 12 Habits for Christian Leaders. And we're going to continue with Connecting Faith in a moment. It's Monday, which means we got a health moment with Lisa Marone. That's all ahead. Stay tuned. To Connecting Faith, and today we want to talk about headaches, and maybe you've experienced them, maybe hopefully they're not a regular part of your daily life, but for many that's the reality, and we're going to find out a bit more about it today as we take time out for our Monday Health Moment with Lisa Marone. Lisa's a physical therapist, a professor, author, and speaker, and encourages people to get healthy for heaven's sake. It's the title of one of her great books. She's written a number of them. You can find out more about her regular weekly a Monday Health Moment online. It's lisamarone.com. We get together with her every other Monday. And Lisa, I wanted to talk about headaches today, particularly sinus headaches. And, you know, a lot of people are dealing with aches and pains in the head. That's sadly not that uncommon, is it?
Yeah, you know, come spring, we certainly have a whole lot of seasonal allergies that start to spike here. But I have patients all year round that come in and tell me they're having sinus headaches. And so I always ask my patients, even my neck pain patients, when they come for an evaluation, I ask them, you know, do you experience headaches? And they'll tell me, oh, yeah, I do, but that's something different. That's my sinuses. And then as I'm treating their neck during a treatment, they'll say, hey, you know, that's kind of funny. While you're doing that in my neck, my sinuses are clearing. And then I have to explain to them, well, that's because it's not actually your sinuses that are full. It's the sensation that your sinuses are full, and it's coming from your neck. And so it's really important that when we have these headaches, we don't just keep popping pills for them, that we actually figure out what's behind them.
We'll talk about it here in the moments ahead, but maybe we should start out with a definition. Is there a definition of a real sinus headache?
Yeah, you know, a sinus headache is going to be... it's going to come along with sinus issues. So you might have drainage, like you might be blowing your nose all the time. Your eyes might be watery as well. Or you can have tremendous congestion where you can't sleep at night. You can't breathe well through your nose. That's telling us that the linings of the sinuses are actually inflamed. When those linings get inflamed, there's all these little nerve endings in those linings, and so those are going to produce pain typically across the bridge of the nose or underneath the eyes, across the cheekbones, and we'll have a really heavy, dull pressure there. And we might even have just had a cold in the last couple of weeks that didn't clear, and we may even run a low-grade fever. Those are more signs of a sinus headache when you're having those other symptoms along with it.
But as you said, you're oftentimes you're treating neck pain, and there's an association there. So say more about that.
There is something called cervicogenic headache, and that means that the cervical spine or the neck has generated the headache. And so it's very important to be able to have someone look at your neck, specifically the upper half of your neck and your head, to see whether that is producing the head pain that you're experiencing. It's very interesting that many patients have what they would call migraine headaches even, and those are based in the neck as well, because the upper part of your spinal cord and the nerves that exit on the first three levels, they are so interconnected with your brain in terms of the way that they feed back up into the head, brain, and face that it's very difficult to distinguish which is what. So we can still get pressure across our cheekbones or between our eyes to our forehead, and all of that can be stemming from the upper neck region.
So in terms of treatment, should we be doing neck massages or, you know, getting one of those maybe battery-operated handheld, you know, massage balls or some of those things? I mean, would that make a difference?
Yeah, you know, I find a skilled pair of hands is the best bet. I am very I am leery about people getting treatment for their neck that includes what's called high-velocity manipulation. Layman would call that getting your neck cracked. Mm. The neck is very, very sensitive. There are blood vessels that run through the actual spine bones in our neck, and we don't want those to be torn and end up with any kind of stroke symptoms. And so we really want to make sure that that is not part of the regimen that you seek. But whether you're seeking massage or you're seeking skilled hands that can evaluate the joints and the discs and the muscles in the head and neck region, that's going to be really important. Some people even have jaw joint problems that will refer pain up into the head and face as well. And so getting to a practitioner who knows how to evaluate and is looking for specific findings that maybe your general doctor isn't even aware of because it's not in their scope of practice, that's important to find a good manual physical therapist.
We often go to medications first, though, don't we? And lots of over-the-counter medications for headaches, pain relief. So a good idea, not so good.
Well, you know, Neil, medicines for the head are very interesting because the brain is easily made to be an addict. And so, interestingly, headache medication can cause headaches because when the brain doesn't have the substance you've been feeding it, and it's become addicted to that substance, the way that it gets more of that substance into the body is by creating another headache. And so those are called drug rebound headaches. And so oftentimes I have to wean my patients off of their headache medication and tell them, listen, your brain is going to kind of like explode in pain when you take this away from it, almost like a toddler that you just took a candy bar away from. It's going to scream for a while, but you need to get over that. You need to know that that's what's happening and get past that. And once they do, they're so excited to be freed from taking either over-the-counter medication or, you know, their doctor-prescribed medication with his or her acknowledgement. That's a good way to go because that medicine, Neil, can just be that can be the cause eventually of a headache.
So things like plenty of liquids, just rest and those things, I mean, sometimes it doesn't seem like those, you know, make the headache go away.
Well, oftentimes there are secondary effects in our body that can create headache. Certainly dehydration can cause headaches. And so if you're not well hydrated, start hydrating yourself. Put yourself out a big bottle of, you know, 60-some-odd ounces of water in the morning and make sure it's drunk by nighttime. But you can also have thyroid issues. And if your thyroid gland isn't functioning well, you can get headaches. Another thing to look for is your sugar levels. Inadequate sugar, if your sugar drops too low, that can create head pain because the brain lives on sugar. And so if it doesn't have enough, it will create a headache. Another thing that's really important in thinking about head pain is when does that head pain come on? You know, is this something that you wake up in the morning with terrible headaches and they fade during the day? Well, now we want to think about, well, maybe my pillow is not adequate or my sleep position is working against me. Or is it you wake up in the morning and you feel grand and then you're feeling bad as the day goes on. Now we're looking at stress or postures that we might need to change up.
Yeah, I was woke up this morning thinking I probably shouldn't have had that chocolate dessert that I had last night because that sort of set me off a little bit. And I'm sure foods are probably a real part of headache causes, too.
For people who have a sensitive brain, it can be.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You're affirming me. That was basically what I was just waiting for you to do. So thanks for. No. I'm going to tell my wife
so
as soon as I get home.
Red wine, yeah. Eight sure. Cheeses, all of those things. If you have a sensitive brain, those are going to bother your head.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if we can go beyond that, Lisa. I feel like we've sort of covered the topic right there. I mean, I'd like to just leave it there with the sensitive brain. No, just no. Any other? We got just a minute left. Any final encouragement about headaches, people that are dealing with them? They're no fun, that's for sure.
Well, they're no fun, but they are treatable. And so I wrote this book, Overcoming Headaches and Migraines, because I have treated for almost 30 years now patients with chronic head pain, people who've been diagnosed as migraines, and when I treat the upper cervical spine, I can even cure migraines in my patients who are sensitive to their hormones, who are sensitive to foods, who are sensitive to stress, to smells, because when you take the component of the upper neck dysfunction out, the rest of those irritants don't build high enough to create a migraine. So that's really exciting to me.
All right, check it out. One of Lisa Marone's great books, Overcoming Headaches and Migraines. She's written a number of books, including Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake, and that's really why we're getting together on a regular basis every Monday. Lisa sends out a Monday Health the Minute. You can sign up for it at lisamarone.com. Lisa Marone, physical therapist and professor, author, and speaker. And we always love talking with you, Lisa. Blessings to you. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Neil.
Christine Duffley has seen God do amazing things through prayer. When she adopted her nephew, Christopher, who is blind and autistic, she knew she would face challenges. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count, and Christine says prayer has been her lifeline.
When we have special needs children, we do worry about what's going to happen when we get to public school. I was full of trepidation. What would that be like, and who would be with my child? And I prayed for that person, and God did answer that prayer. Christopher has an aide. Her name is Lisa. This woman is a believer, and she has a heart for God, and she has a heart for my son.
When God used Christopher's CD and YouTube video to reach hundreds of thousands of people, Christine knew whom to thank first.
When Christopher's CD came out, I ran over to her house, and I said, "This is because you're part of his life."
What an amazing answer to prayer.
Hey, just a reminder, you know, we've got a wonderful service, a feature on our website called Prayer Works, a place where you can leave a prayer request and you can pray for others. You have a passion to pray for others, and there's a need there that you want the body to pray about. You can check that out. Go to myfaithradio.com and look for Prayer Works. And by the way, when you're there, you'll see update on our partnership with Food for the Poor this month. Thank you for your willingness to invest in being the hands and feet of Jesus in very real ways. You can get details on that online as well, myfaithradio.com. I want to encourage you to join us tomorrow. Speaking of autistic children, we've got a powerful story. You're going to want to listen to it with the Wilsons tomorrow on Connecting Faith. We'll see you back here then. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. Now, these conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.